Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Hard to believe, but another week has flown by. So it is time to catch up on what's been happening lately across the city and state in our weekly news recap. We sat down with journalists working on stories like these.
Former Chicago Alderwoman Carrie Austin found unfit for trial on federal corruption charges.
For undisclosed reasons, the Bureau of Prisons released Burke from the Thompson Correctional Center.
He still will have very strict conditions. He will just be serving his sentence in his home.
Chicago Alders say they're gathering information on this visit to the National Museum of Puerto Rican Arts and Culture.
We will never allow people to be kidnapped, intimidated, bully.
They say the agents were asked by museum staff to leave, but refused.
Heather Chiron, Chicago politics reporter for WTTW. Madison Saavedra, Block Club Chicago reporter covering Rogers Park, Edgewater, and Uptown. And Alden Lowry, WBEZ data projects editor, joined us. Madison started off by explaining what happened when Homeland Security agents gathered in the parking lot of the Puerto Rican Arts and Cultural Center in Humboldt Park on Tuesday.
It remains pretty unclear exactly what they were doing. In a statement, Homeland Security press secretary said that the accusations that they were there to, you know, arrest or track down undocumented immigrants were false. They said that it was Chicago's Financial Crimes Task Force was holding a quick briefing ahead of an enforcement action related to a narcotics investigation. So that's their official story. However, local officials and neighbors, in no uncertain terms, condemned the behavior as like threatening towards undocumented neighbors, because this is in a, you know, highly Latino populated part of the city. So
right.
They really saw it as a show of aggression, a show of force, a tactic to intimidate people.
Yeah. So folks at the museums thought that this was a bullying and intimidation tactic. Meanwhile, the agents are saying, no, we were just holding a briefing meeting. We just happened to be using your parking lot.
Pretty much, which is strange.
What a parking lot to pick.
Right. And it's private property. You know, the museum leases this building, leases the property. And when they asked people, they asked these officers to leave, they did not. Leave.
Yeah.
they did not comply.
So more than a dozen local officials gathered at the cultural center on Wednesday to speak out about this. I want to play a little bit here from 35th Ward Alder Anthony Quezada.
It was meant to send a message to our undocumented neighbors, to our cultural institutions, and to our entire community that they are being watched and that they are not safe. But let us be absolutely clear. We reject that message. We will not be intimidated. We will not allow federal overreach to violate our rights or our spaces, and we will resist.
Is this a he said, she said kind of thing here, Alden? What do you see it as?
Regardless of what the true intention was of the federal agents, I think the optics have to be pretty clear for anyone knowing the moment that the presence of federal agents in this community and in this particular space is a very kind of sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
For that community, that it would have that it would send that kind of a message, even if that wasn't the ultimate objective there.
Yeah. What are you thinking, Heather?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things at play. One, we know from the public statements by Trump administration officials that they want to strike fear into the hearts of undocumented immigrants. And I think that it is a difficult story for us to cover as reporters because our instinct is to say, oh, well, the federal federal government said that's not what happened. And there has been, you know, historically, traditionally, a presumption of trust that federal agents would not lie to the news media. I think that we have ample evidence to make it clear that the Trump administration does not operate that way.
Yeah, that trust is shifting.
Correct. And I think that we saw something very similar play out several months ago when Social Security agents went to a school on the, you know, in a primarily Latino community, and CPS officials said they were ICE agents. And then a couple hours later, you know, it was like, oh, no, they're not actually ICE agents. They're just Department of Homeland Security agents. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to be, as reporters, sort of skeptical to a greater degree about sort of granting federal officials the ability to sort of, you know, dissuade people from feeling afraid or right. threatened, when it's clear that that is part of their political strategy.
Yeah. And we know Puerto Ricans, of course, are U.S. citizens, but Madison, was there some talk that people were fearful that these agents were also preparing for raids at like upcoming neighborhood festivals, Latino festivals?
Yes,
are,
that was
like,
definitely
around
a
the
big,
corner.
Yeah, definitely a big point of concern. There's the Colombian Fest that's taking place in Humboldt Park's namesake park. Mexican Independence Day parade is obviously far off, but just these types of events where it's going to draw people from all walks of life, people from all different kinds of nationalities. You know, right. it could be undocumented people from many different countries, not necessarily from Puerto Rico specifically. Mm-hmm. And I completely agree with everything Heather said, that we can't 100% know what their intentions were. We can't 100% trust what the federal agents are saying, but they see the news. Like, they know what the atmosphere is like. Like, they know the kind of tone they're setting and the mm-hmm. responses that people are having. So by being so ambiguous and not identifying themselves to museum staff, these federal agents, they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm.
Well, relatedly, the city has now joined a lawsuit that challenges President Trump for withholding federal funding from sanctuary cities. What are the details, Heather?
Well, I got to push back just a little bit yeah. because it's all very legal and technical. But essentially, a bunch of California cities, along with some other cities, several months ago sued the Trump administration to stop it from yanking funding to sanctuary cities. Chicago was not part of that lawsuit, which has already sort of gotten to the point where we have a federal judge has issued a preliminary injunction saying when it comes to those cities, the Trump administration can't yank any funding. Mm-hmm. Now, Chicago has asked that same judge to allow it to join that lawsuit. But the way that it works in federal court is that you can't just willy-nilly join a lawsuit that you were not originally part of. So now the city is seeking leave from the judge to basically sort of jump on that bandwagon. Right. Since that case has gotten sort of the farthest towards resolution. Now, the Trump administration is appealing that initial preliminary injunction, and appeals court hasn't ruled yet. But there was clearly an analysis by the Chicago's law department that this suit presents the best sort of chance for the city to prevent the Trump administration from yanking its officials. So it's not clear whether the judge will allow that. If it doesn't, I would expect Chicago and the other cities that wanted to join that lawsuit will file a separate yeah. lawsuit. However, we have all been waiting since the end of April for a federal judge to rule in the case brought against Chicago and Cook County by the Trump administration, basically seeking to overturn the Illinois Trust Act and the city's welcoming city ordinance, which is those protections for undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. So that lawsuit has been fully briefed. The city has asked the judge to dismiss that lawsuit. We are just waiting for that judge to rule. And every morning I wake up and I check the docket and I think, will today be the day? And it never is.
It never
at least
is.
Yet. Yeah. So it's a little bit in flux, but I think that it's clear that the city's law department is very aggressively trying to prevent the federal government from taking funding away
even
from the city.
Even if it means willy-nilly, as you said, hopping onto another lawsuit
Correct.
That it had nothing to do with. And when you talk about yanking funds, like, we're talking about a lot of money here, Alden. Chicago's supposed to receive some $3.5 billion in federal dollars this year. So could you actually see Trump being able to withhold that?
Yes. I mean, I don't think we should be surprised at how far the administration will go, nor should we be surprised at apparently the ability of this administration to govern through executive order. you know, even in the face of legal fights to prevent that. It's been a case essentially of the administration does what it wants, mm-hmm. and then it's up to anyone who's impacted to play defense in order to get that to stop that. So and he's been very transparent from day one about going after sanctuary cities and yep. particularly going after Chicago. So
before day one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we were hearing all the rumors.
Wouldn't it all be surprised if that ultimately is where he yeah. tries to land?
Good point. Mayor Johnson also joined other Democrats this week in condemning that tax and spending bill that was signed into law by President Trump on the 4th of July. What did Johnson have to say?
He said it was unholy, that it was sinful, that it was an abomination. So mincing few words. And I think that not only is the city's finances in a little bit of a crisis, and not only are these facing these other threats from the federal government, but this bill really sort of attacks the social safety net as we have known it, with food assistance mm-hmm. and housing assistance,
Medicaid.
And it is clear that once those sort of changes go into effect, the city and the state will be asked to do more to prevent people from falling into poverty. And it is clear that the city and state's ability to do that is distinctly limited. Yeah. And I think that that's the point that the mayor was trying to get across.
Say more, Alden, on how that bill could impact our city's finances.
Well, Heather said it well in terms of, you know, if that federal funding is lost, then the burden shifts to the state, to the city. I think Governor Pritzker suggested as much as $1 billion mm-hmm. The state would have to kind of come up with in order to kind of help fill that gap. That number would be significant for the city of Chicago as well. Literally tens of thousands of Chicagoans are dependent on all of those programs, whether it's housing, it's Medicaid, or SNAP assistance. And the benefits of that aid, while those folks are struggling, many have talked about in the kind of the shadows of this decision that, no, we have not righted many of those social problems, mm-hmm. but the safety net has been instrumental in keeping many people afloat.
Before we leave the topic of federal funding, Madison, despite receiving $3.75 million from the government, the YMCA in Westridge near Rogers Park, it remains closed. And I hear that's frustrating, of course, a lot of area residents. What's the latest?
Yeah, so this has been kind of a years in the making issue. The High Ridge YMCA in Westridge closed in 2021, and the YMCA cited like declining memberships and just general financial issues as a reason why it closed. And then it kind of had a second life. It was a migrant shelter in 2022. It no longer is used in that capacity, at least for a year now. But later that year, U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky had said she had earmarked $3.75 million in federal funds to help the YMCA reopen. Now, at the time, the YMCA didn't say in explicit words, mm-hmm. we are going to reopen, but that was the assumption. Mm-hmm. And I did a story last fall kind of checking in on where that project stood, because neighbors were like, hey, it's been almost 2 years. There's
What's
been no construction.
On?
What's going on? Lo and behold, now the YMCA says they actually don't have the money to reopen it, even with this federal fund. They said the building is just in too poor condition, and they're exploring options like potentially selling the site to a developer, though they hope a YMCA could still exist there. You know, if they were to sell it to a new owner, you know, you can do whatever you want with it. You can do whatever you want with it.
Yes.
Or potentially not put it there. So,
yeah,
this is something I'll definitely keep looking into. The area's alderwoman said, you know, maybe some city funding could help. You know, she said never say never, but it seems kind of unlikely.
Well, at least she's still hopeful.
Yeah.
Bless her heart. Heather, I'm looking at you. A judge ruled that former 34th Ward Alder Carrie Austin, she represents represented the far south side, parts of the far south side, she's unfit to stand trial. What's going on?
Well, she was charged all the way back in July of 2021 of essentially taking bribes and lying to FBI agents about it. And her court case was first delayed by the COVID-19 pandemic, and then it was delayed by the massive amount of evidence in the case that had to be turned over to the defense. And by that point, she was, her lawyers say, essentially too sick to withstand the rigors of a federal trial. Now, she has had a number of health issues over the years. She is a survivor of breast cancer. She has significant problems breathing, and in fact, at one point collapsed on the floor of the city council and had to be revived by another alderperson in a very, very dramatic moment. And essentially, the an expert in sort of pulmonary health ruled that she was too sick and that the trial could essentially shorten her lifespan, and the judge agreed this week. And it is nearly unprecedented for something like this to happen, but I think it is an indication of sometimes when you delay court cases, they get away from you. And representatives of the U.S. Attorney's Office wouldn't comment on the judge's decision, but they tried very hard to convince the judge that she could withstand a trial, and the judge said she wasn't, but he was also very pointed in her ruling, in his ruling, that essentially Austin will now live what is likely to be the rest of her life under this perpetual cloud of suspicion, because of course she is presumed innocent, but she will also never get a chance to clear her name. And
we'll never know.
Right.
Yeah. Your thoughts on that, Alden, the fact that Carrie Austin may never stand trial.
I mean, judging by her, you know, kind of medical condition, it may seem humane in some way, but in a way it also seems like a disservice, because Austin is one of the old guard. I mean, the truly Chicago political old guard. Mm-hmm. Inherited the seat, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
From her husband, who was a long time alderman. I remember my own little funny story about one of Carrie Austin's constituents who approached me because she claimed the alderman was essentially kind of trying to strong arm her into kind of giving up a piece of property, and looked into it, and there was actually a little bit of credibility to that claim. But that's kind of the politics that Austin is known to have done. So for a case to have been brought forward and not to kind of go through would seem, like I said, would be somewhat of a disservice, especially now that we're in this era where we finally have been able to go after some of Chicago's political heavyweights, from Burke and Madigan. Austin is a lower level, but still among that class.
Mm-hmm. So Austin, because of the judge's ruling, she still gets to collect her pension.
Correct.
Of what, $9,500 a month?
Yes. And she served for decades on the city council. So that, you know, she makes nearly $90,000 a year in pension, and that will go up every year by about 3%. And you can only sort of yank back somebody's pension if they're convicted of committing crimes as part of their public role. So this is something that she will be able to draw for the rest of her life.
Real quick, before we take a pause, let's just pivot to another disgraced alderman, Ed Burke. What's the latest?
Like, which one were you going to say?
There's I know there were several names I could have picked from there, but Ed Burke, what's the latest on him, Madison?
Yeah, so he was transferred out of the low security prison that he had been in for about 9 months. He was handed a 2-year sentence for this this racketeering, bribery, extortion trial I'm sure we're all very familiar with. The 2-year sentence in and of itself raised some eyebrows, if I'm remembering correctly. And now he's served only about nine months, and he's going to serve the rest of it from his home, I believe, right? Community confinement is, you know, more or
he's
less.
He's in a halfway house
home
right
or
now.
Halfway okay. house. What was the decision
He
there?
Will eventually be released from the halfway house
to his home.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that's 9 months. His brother had said that he had lost a lot of weight in prison, that he was so hunched over, people who knew him in his heyday would barely recognize him. nothing explicitly about why he was released, that it was like because he's in any kind of poor condition. But that definitely seems to be maybe something that was being hinted at.
Well, worked out for him, didn't it?
So we're going to turn to an issue now that we have talked about extensively here on Reset. You have also reported on extensively with a capital E, Heather. Police misconduct settlements here in Chicago. So four of them are on Monday's agenda for the City Council's Finance Committee. Why don't we start with the botched raid that involves a family with two young kids?
Right. So this happened all the way back in 2017. Officers were trying to find somebody that they believed was a very dangerous drug dealer, and they broke down the door of the Mendez family in McKinley Park. And it turned out the people that the cops were looking for were upstairs. But despite the family's protestations, hey, you're looking for our sleazy upstairs neighbors, not us, they handcuffed the father and, the family said, pointed M14 assault rifles at the two kids, who were 5 and 9 at the time. And they, you know, sort of, you know, eventually went away. But the family says that their kids and everybody was severely traumatized.
Oh, sure.
And they sued the city. And the city actually took that lawsuit to trial. And the trial was ongoing. And Peter Mendez, who was the 9-year-old at the time, testified in federal court that he thought the cops were going to murder his father before his eyes. And that afterwards, he struggled in school. He struggled with his friends. And it really had a profound impact on his life. Immediately after that now teenager testified, the city settled the case. And yesterday we learned that they have agreed to pay the city $2.5 million.
After a trial had already begun, which is very rare.
Very unusual. So not only is the city going to pay this family $2.5 million, some of which will of course go to their lawyers, the city has already paid more than $600,000 to defend these officers' conduct, even though the city admits that they were in the wrong place and that this family was not the target of the raid. And of course, this comes from a long line of problems with the way that the Chicago Police Department has administered search warrants. I think it's especially heartbreaking, I think, you know, as a mom to think about what those kids went through. But this happened years before Anjanette Young.
Right. Years. Okay, so this was before that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that was my, Anjanette Young was my introduction to this city. That was when I got here.
Welcome.
Yeah.
And I think that for her, that is an indication that there were years of problems with search warrants. And the city is still in the process of sort of figuring out how to resolve that policy and put new restrictions on how this works. Now, that hasn't been finalized yet. And if you remember, Mayor Brandon Johnson campaigned on banning no-knock warrants. Now, the Mendez raid was a no-knock warrant. This policy would not ban no-knock warrants.
Yeah.
And it would also not prevent police officers in exigent circumstances from pointing weapons at children. The mayor also promised to prevent cops from doing that. And that is not what the current proposed policy is. So this is very much a live issue, and it is unresolved even all these years later.
So here's something else that was mentioned in the lawsuit, Alden. CPD was unwilling to pay to fix the doors that the officers broke. Apparently the apartment's front doors, the building doors, the closet door. What do you make of that? Least they can do?
I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, the city, we've just talked about all the payouts for misconduct. Some of the payouts that the city has that aren't considered misconduct payouts, but are for, I mean, literally car accidents that happen during car chases.
You hit a pothole, you can file a claim with the city and say, hey, my axle is broken because you failed to maintain the road.
So at the least, if somebody, you know, administers a warrant that they're not supposed to, or they get the wrong address, that you could replace the damage that you caused in the aftermath of that.
And help me if I'm missing anything here, but all seven officers, Heather, that were involved in this botchery, they were found to have violated CPD rules. Superintendent Brown recommended one officer be suspended for 60 days, two be suspended for 30 days, three for 5 days, and one for 3 days. So it kind of, you know, goes down from there. All remain active duty members of CPD, though. Now, you have reported on this over the years, too, Alden, police misconduct. And have you found what we're talking about here to be common, like police remaining on the job even after doing something so egregious and violating the rules in this way?
It is very difficult to I would say it's very difficult for an officer to be disciplined, but it's very difficult for an officer to be fired. Now, it has become more common for officers to be placed on some type of administrative leave or some type of suspension or some things, or, you know, where they're taken off the street. But in terms to actually separate them from the department or to formally suspend them in some way, that's been a longstanding issue and remains so.
Yeah. Well, city lawyers recommended resolving another settlement involving what's sadly become a household name in Chicago, former Chicago Police Commander John Burge. Details of this one.
Well, this is one of, I think, the most egregious Burge-related cases. It involved Jackie Wilson, who was arrested and charged and tried three times in the 1982 murder of two Chicago police officers. He said that he was tortured and coerced into confessing. He has alleged that...
He said he was electrocuted by officers?
He says that officers hooked up cables to his ears and attached them to a battery and electric shocked him.
Wow.
And now those allegations are not just allegations. They have been found to be true. A judge tossed his confession, ordered a retrial. This man has been tried three times and has been declared factually innocent by a judge. Now, this settlement would pay him $12.7 million. He's also sued Cook County, which settled for $17 million because he alleges that after he was tortured by Chicago police detectives, he was framed by Cook County prosecutors.
Mm. And that's really an indictment of the whole
system.
Judicial system.
And I know it seems like ancient sort of history, but at the time that this occurred, former Mayor Richard M. Daley was Cook County State's attorney. And this lawsuit not only named John Burge, but it named Richard Daley and it named two Chicago police superintendents. And I think that it is one of the last remaining cases where somebody is still alive and can sort of attempt to hold the city responsible for this, you know, and I'm not an opinion journalist, but I don't think anybody looks back on this period of Chicago history and thinks it's anything but an egregious sort of shameful moment in our history.
Yeah. One more here. I'm going to keep you in the hot seat, Heather, because this is the largest of the four settlements on Monday's agenda. $17 million. What are the details here?
Well, that money would go to a man who spent nearly 23 years in prison after he says he was framed by another Chicago police detective, this one, Reynaldo Guevara, who has a well-documented and uncontested record of misconduct where he routinely framed suspects, primarily Latino men, accused of crimes and sort of on the west side in the Humboldt Park area. And that in this case, Guevara is accused of essentially going to one of the other victims in this double murder and saying, this guy did it, pointing to the defendant, and he was convicted and sent to prison and only released after investigations began into his conduct. Now, mm-hmm. He is no longer a Chicago police detective. He lives in Texas, but he is also drawing a pension because he has never been accused of discipline. He has never been subjected to discipline. Mm-hmm. And Illinois law prevents pensions from being taken from people who have not been found guilty of a crime.
Wow. Let's move along here, Alden, and talk about what the mayor is doing here. He's trying to push Chicagoans to build what are often called granny flats on their properties. Give me both sides of this issue here.
Sure. So these, I guess the technical term is accessory dwelling units. Imagine you've got a home and you want to, you renovate the basement or the attic, or you've got a carriage house or something like that, and you want to rent it out, you know. So the mayor wants to make it essentially grant homeowners the carte blanche authority to essentially open those things up. On the other side of that, you've got particularly some alders, Marty Quinn among them, who really want the alderman to have the authority to say whether that's okay or not. Mm-hmm. A compromise proposal that had been offered by one alderman was essentially to, in areas zoned R1 or R2, for there to be a requirement for a special use permit. And that would open the door to an alderman essentially having kind of veto authority to prevent those allowances in some instances, per the longstanding kind of policy of aldermanic prerogative.
Yeah.
And which I forgive me for this, but I just keep thinking of this image of Marty Quinn prancing around like Bobby Brown saying it is his prerogative. We should keep that in play. Sorry for that, but that just came to mind.
If you know what Marty Quinn looks like, it's especially funny.
And if you know that Bobby Brown song,
yes, you are
also laughing.
So so that's where we stand. The mayor wants a vote on this. He wants a proposal to come forward that grants the right. But there's some who are asking, who don't think the mayor may have the votes, but the mayor wants to give it a go, see if he can get it through before considering a compromise like the one that was offered.
We'll have to see if he'll have the votes. Now, sticking with affordable housing, there's a ribbon cutting for the first two factory-built homes in a new Cook County pilot program. Madison, tell us more.
Yeah, so these were really cool. My colleague Ariel at Block Club wrote about these. It's this modular house company that are factory building these homes and putting them on. They put them on two plots of vacant land in Humboldt Park. It's like the first set under this new pilot program. It's really cool. I encourage everyone to go to the store and look at the photos because they're not what I was expecting when I first heard.
Regular homes.
Yeah. Right? And apparently, I mean, I think one of the biggest draws to a program like this is that they can build them a lot quicker, which also I imagine makes it more cost efficient. But these three bedroom homes are selling for around $350,000, and nearby houses in the same area are much higher. So I think that the intention is really to help provide ownership opportunities, but at an affordable rate, not just necessarily rental opportunities.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there are going to be 120 of them built in three designated communities. And as you just walked us through the first two, they're in Humboldt Park. Mm-hmm. People earning up to 120% of the county's median income. Mm-hmm. Those are the folks they're looking for. Yep. And those nearby houses that you're talking about, Madison, I mean, they're going for like anywhere from $525,000 up to like $800,000. So this is, if you think about the difference, so you said what, $350,000?
Yeah, about.
That's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
We got a little bit more housing news here, Alden. Mayor Johnson confirmed 27th Ward Alder Walter Burnett. He's one of the top choices to lead the CHA. Tell us about him.
Walter Burnett is the longest-serving current alder, longest-serving Black alder in Chicago history, if I understand correctly, as well, and has deep ties to public housing. Himself, born in Rockwell Gardens, I think his grandmother's Rockwell Gardens apartment, spent pretty much all of his childhood in Cabrini Green, and has been a long-time public housing and affordable housing advocate. He spoke about this as being kind of like a capstone type of post, if he were to get it, given his connection to public housing. So, he says he's got other offers on the table, he's leaving office. He says
he's like, either way, I'm out.
He's out. Turns 62 next month, I believe. So we'll see where that goes.
He wants his 29-year-old son to fill his seat. Heather, what do you think?
That is a long-standing and proud Chicago tradition. So the way that it works is that if a sitting alder person resigns, it's up to the mayor to replace him or her. And we saw this happen when Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa was tapped to lead the Chicago Park District. Johnson picked then Cook County Commissioner Anthony Quezada to fill his spot. Anthony Quezada was Ramirez Rosa's pick to replace him. There was at least some community process where people who were interested were able to sort of send their resume to the mayor's office. Mm-hmm. But if you don't think that Walter R. Burnett III has the inside track on replacing Walter Burnett, I have a bridge in Brooklyn. I would like to speak with you about selling. But this is sort of how it has worked in the past, for better or for worse. Proponents of the system say it ensures continuity, right? You don't want somebody on the city council who doesn't know anything, right? You want to have somebody who's there who can sort of take over and sort of hit the ground running. On the other hand, you have a system where you have entrenched sort of families seizing power and keeping power for decades.
Yeah.
And, you know, that can have, benefits, and it can lead to, rampant corruption.
Oh, it sure can.
But what I think, assuming that Walter Burnett does get the CHA spot, and I think it is telling that the CHA board was supposed to meet on Tuesday, but has delayed that meeting until July 29th, which would be after the last city council meeting in July, and about the time when Walter Burnett says that he will officially submit his resignation. So just reading a little tea leaves
there
for you guys. But he has been a key ally for Mayor Johnson, even though he endorsed Paul Vallis during the last election. Mm. And he was a key ally for Lori Lightfoot, even though he endorsed Tony Preckwinkle in the 2019 election. Walter Burnett is a politician the likes of which Chicago will not see again anytime soon. Mm. Everybody likes him. Mm. He knows everybody. He knows their kids' names. He knows where they go to school. And he is liked by everyone on the city council, by the most conservative member to the most progressive member. And he has been somebody that the mayor has relied on to sort of talk to those competing, power centers and broker deals. Now, the budget fight this year, which will begin in earnest in August, is going to be so hard and nasty and fraught.
Yeah.
And without having Walter Burnett there, I think is going to be very difficult for the mayor.
End of an era, for sure.
Yes.
The village of Dalton, meanwhile, has officially bought the childhood home of Pope Leo XIV for $375,000. So that's another home we're going to keep an eye on to see what they decide to do with it. Alden, NASCAR roared into town last weekend. I don't know if you heard anything or saw anything there, but
I got stuck in traffic.
You got stuck in the traffic. It was the third race in NASCAR's 3-year contract with our city. Are they coming back? Is that it? Are we done?
I would say yes, especially if they can find another weekend other than the 4th of July. That's going to be a trouble spot for a very kind of dense NASCAR schedule, but there seems to be good vibes if it's not on the 4th. The mayor said, they're very open to it coming back. But some alders have said they would like to see it sometime other than the 4th of July.
Other than the 4th of July.
So we'll see where
I wonder
that goes.
What weekend they'll pick. I feel like Chicagoans will complain either
NASCAR's
way.
NASCAR's got 90 days to kind of submit a request to extend it. So we'll see what happens. But it's performed well. It did better in 2024 than it did in 2023. It'll be a few months before we know how well it did this year. $128 mm-hmm. million dollars economic impact. Over 50,000 people who attended, half of whom came explicitly for NASCAR. So.
Yeah, I mean, anything's better than 2023 with all that flooding, right? That was a lot. So this happened during 4th of July weekend, of course, Alden, which reportedly was a time where this year we saw fewer shootings. What are officials attributing that to, though?
So it should be noted that even though the numbers were lower than they have been in most recent years, the numbers are still troubling. There were two mass shootings the 4th of July weekend. There was one major one just before the 4th of July in River mm-hmm. North. And the numbers, 11 people killed, over 50, 60 people shot. A number of things have been said. Police have talked about greater collaboration with prosecutors. They've talked about greater collaborations with communities on the ground, and we've reported on the success that has been seen with community violence intervention programs and how their primary focus is essentially stopping the retaliatory actions. And if you know Chicago violence, you know that one shooting can literally lead to 3 or 4 or even more, mm-hmm. Additional shootings. And so being able to keep one shooting as one shooting can actually have a dramatic impact. And these outreach workers are folks who grew up in these neighborhoods. They know the neighborhoods, they know the networks, they know the cliques. Mm-hmm. And so they are perhaps best positioned to step in, try to calm things down and prevent a shooting from happening again. More positioned than police officers.
And I'm curious, when we say that the numbers were lower, fewer shootings this year, what does that compare to? Where were we last year?
I can't remember the numbers exactly from last year, but I know through June we had fewer than 200 murders. And through April, through May, they were like the lowest figures that far into the year in like at least a decade. And I think the same holds true for the numbers we saw for June. We haven't seen these kinds of numbers since 2014, 2013, somewhere around there.
Over a decade. Yeah, it's a long time. Another thing last weekend, those 4th of July fireworks. Did you all hear a lot of fireworks in
How
your neighborhoods?
How could we not?
I heard fireworks leading up to the long weekend.
I still hear fireworks, yeah. Madison. Yeah, I heard something last night. And, you know, and I was like, what? And I looked up, and sure enough, they were fireworks. It carried on for days and days after. But, you know, even though what's stunning is that even though they're banned here in Chicago, every year we see all these unofficial firework displays. And sometimes they can be seriously dangerous. They lead to injuries, sometimes even death. That is what's happened to a couple of employees at Humboldt Park, isn't it, Madison?
Yeah, this was unfortunate. Two Chicago Park District employees were seriously injured after they lit some leftover fireworks that they found at Humboldt Park Beach. They sustained like injuries to their hands, and a Humboldt Park neighbor who spoke to one of my colleagues anonymously said that she heard these loud loud explosions. The neighbor ran over to help one of the employees, and it looked like maybe someone was missing some fingers as a result of these injuries.
Oh, no.
So very unfortunate, especially considering the fireworks are not allowed in the Park District, and these are Park District employees. But the district is cooperating with the police's investigation.
Mm. But so they just picked up leftover fireworks and got into this mess.
Mm. Well, I believe they lit them.
Yeah.
But and yeah. Then,
well, yeah. I mean, picked up and lit. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't even just
yeah.
It
they, yeah. It, unfortunate, but I hope they recover okay.
Yes. Missing several fingers. That's no good. Yeah. Prayers out to them. Madison, I believe you've got some good news, and this is the time, this is the portion of the recap that we like to turn to that sort of thing. Uptown's Clarendon Park Community Center, it's reopened after a $13 million renovation.
Yeah, so this has also been years in the making. It was supposed to open in 2023, but the building conditions just made it take longer. But now it's open, and it is stunning. They have this new fitness space, dance studio, this outdoor plaza leading you into the facilities.
Wow.
Two big factors. Also, it is now ADA accessible, and it has air conditioning. The area's alderwoman, Angela Clay, said she is an Uptown native. She grew up going to the Clarendon Park Community Center, and she described it as, you know, a lovely place. Like, it was a home, it was a community, but she said it was sweaty and hot in there, and now it has this beautiful air conditioning system. So it's really a great amenity for the community to have access to again, especially because this community center has such a history. It was built in 1916 as a bathhouse back when Lake Michigan actually came up that far before they filled in the lake, and then it became a community center, not necessarily just a beach house. But
sounds like a huge win for that community, and I don't want to lose sight of the fact that you said it has air conditioning now.
Yeah.
That
some of us grew up in Park District facilities without air conditioning, and we are pleased that this next generation will not have to suffer the way we did.
It's like, yes.
Happy for them.
Round of applause there for the air conditioning. Now, to 22 Southside High School students, they're preparing right now to wow the judges again on America's Got Talent. This is when they head back to L.A. in August. Let's listen to their recent performance on that show. Okay, the entire studio dancing at this point.
I love this video.
This
it gave
choir
me goosebumps
is so
when
cool.
I watched it the first time.
Oh, wow. Well, tell us a little bit about Leo High School, Madison.
Yeah, so this is a school on the south side that takes kids that don't, like this choir, they're not necessarily kids that have this like profound musical or singing background. You know, the adults that shape this choir like are really taking the time to help these kids find their voices, literally. And this is, they've been booked and busy all summer. They they appeared at a mass for the new Pope Leo at Guaranteed Rate Field. They were also at Wrigley Field for a Juneteenth celebration.
Nice.
It's a really cool opportunity. And these kids, you know, on America's Got Talent, they were asked, what they would use this prize money for. And one of the choir kids said that he would use it for college. And as a result of that, after the show aired, a donor actually gave all 22 boys $5,000 each for them to use towards school.
Nice. A donor from Chicago, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and other donors from alumni are coming in. So it seems to be a really cool catalyst for the school community. And I cannot wait to see their next
performance.
What
a sweet story. Yeah, so they're going to LA, as I said, in August. And so we are absolutely rooting them on, rooting for them. Before we wrap, folks, I want to ask real quick what stories you're going to be watching next week, because I know that week won't be short of news either. Heather, what's on your radar?
Well, Wednesday is a city council meeting, and we have a plethora of things potentially on the agenda, but I specifically am watching a Monday vote on a measure that seeks to give Inspector General Deborah Witzberg more power to act independently of the city's law department and the mayor's office. Okay. We talked a little bit about ethics today, and after Burke and after Madigan, this is sort of where the next flashpoint is going to be.
Interesting.
It's going to be interesting.
We shall see. Alden, what's on your plate?
I will be watching for news about my vacation. So I'm hoping it'll get great coverage by local and national outlets.
So you won't be here, you say?
I will not be here.
We are on our own. We are
thrilled for
you. I'll be here in spirit.
See the smile? I'm thrilled for you.
Oh, I love that.
Not jealous at all.
Madison?
Well, the thing I was going to keep my eye out for, it's a zoning measure that affects the Edgewater and Uptown community. I received word right before this segment that it's actually been delayed. I don't think it's going to happen anymore. Oh. So if anything, my week looks a little easier. A little easier for me. But nice. I will hint, I'm working on a couple food-related stories next week for part of Block Club's Eats, our little food-related
newsletter. We love food here on Reset.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye. I got a couple up my sleeve.
That episode of the Reset podcast was produced by Andrea Guffman, edited by Dan Tucker, and mixed by Micah Yasin. In a busy news cycle, we help keep you up to speed on the biggest regional stories. Consider subscribing so that you never miss a conversation. You can also check out our archive at wbez.org/reset. Thanks so much for listening. Have a good weekend.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.